morning, members. It's coffee.
And you. Left over from the Borough Conference.
We do not have a quorum yet, but we are going to start at the precise minutes that most members can get.
Okay. We welcome you to the committee. Glad to have you here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representatives. My name is Molly Schultz, and I'm the Public Policy Director for Conservation Minnesota, formerly the Minnesota League of Conservation Voters. The Minnesota League of Conservation Voters Education Fund is a nonprofit 501c3 which works to inform citizens and provide information to policymakers to further conservation goals. We did recently shorten our name to Conservation Minnesota, but our mission and structure remain the same. Since 2002, one of the projects the League has worked on is an annual analysis of the Governor's Budget for Conservation and Environment. Each February, we summarize the Governor's budget, and each October, we do a wrap-up report to examine the budget as it is actually passed by the legislature. In our analysis, we track the four primary agencies with responsibility for conservation in Minnesota: the DNR, the PCA, the Department of Agriculture, and the Board of Water and Soil Resources. We also track funding for the Met Council Parks, funding for PFA Clean Water Funds, and the LCCMR. The goal of our report is to provide an overall assessment of the trends impacting state spending on conservation and to document the cumulative effect of these trends. And I'm going to turn it over to Cheryl Appledorn, who worked on the budget analysis, and she's just going to give a brief overview.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Cheryl Appledorn. As Ms. Schultz said, the goal of our report is to provide an overall assessment of the trends impacting state spending on conservation and to document the cumulative effect of those trends. Since our first report, which was in 2002, state budget deficits have led to repeated rounds of cuts to conservation budgets. For example, our reports have found that between 2003 and 2006, the DNR alone saw its base general fund budget cut by more than $20 million per year. Also, from 2001 to 2006, Bowser's budget fell from $23 million to $15 million, more than a 30% drop. We also think it's important to note that these cuts that have been seen in conservation agencies are cuts from are not cuts from the amount of their spending adjusted for inflation, not the amount that they should have received with inflation. These are cuts from their base budget. By 2006, our reports have found that the overall result of these cuts was that the share of the state's general fund spent on conservation and environment had sunk to a 30-year low. From 1976 to 2001, the amount spent on conservation in Minnesota averaged about 1.83% and frequently exceeded 2% of the general fund budget. But by 2006, the percent spent on conservation agencies had dropped to a mere 1%. For fiscal 07, there was a slight uptick due to the one-time Clean Water Legacy funding. The share of the general fund allocated to conservation crept up to 1.16%, but it still represented one of the lowest points in 30 years, other than the 2006 year, which really was the low water mark. In this year's report, which we released a couple of weeks ago, we find that the governor does propose some increases for conservation, but that these increases are not enough to substantially change this trend line. Under the governor's budget, spending on conservation will continue to hover near that 30-year low. We think there are also three points to note in considering the governor's budget, particularly the increases proposed by the governor. Many of the increases that the governor recommends restore cuts that were made during these previous years. They don't represent new spending, but they help restore some of the cuts that were made. For example, the governor proposes additional general funds for private forest stewardship, but we have to remember that in 2005, the forestry program was cut by $1.1 million per year. So much of what the governor is now proposing restores that program to where it was previous to the cuts. Second, many of the governor's proposals merely reauthorized spending which was one time or which was scheduled to sunset. So again, the funding proposed by the governor is really needed to continue the status quo. And third, the compensation increases proposed by the governor only partially fund the inflation increases needed in the coming 2 years. They don't address the fact that these budgets have been eroding for the last 4 years, and that many of the conservation programs that are impacted have had to absorb increasing costs by cutting services in these previous years. So our report finds that even with the small increases in reauthorizations proposed by the governor for fiscal years 08 and 09, total spending on the major conservation agencies will have declined by $100 million in inflation-adjusted dollars from 2001 to 2009, which represents an 18% drop in funding. And now, one of the most important findings in our report has to do with the funding for Clean Water Legacy, and Ms. Schultz is going to go into that in a little more detail.
Thank you. In 2006, the legislature passed the Clean Water Legacy Act, which establishes the programs and procedures for identifying and cleaning up our polluted lakes. As you know, Minnesota has a polluted water problem. Of the 16% of the lakes and 10% of the river and stream miles tested, 40% of them have been identified as impaired by the standards set by the Federal Clean Water Act. Beginning in 2003, a group of stakeholders comprised of the business community, agriculture interests, local governments, and environmental groups convened to find a solution. This group, known as the G16, determined that Minnesota requires anywhere from $80 to $100 million annually to address the problem. And it should be noted that $80 million was the low end, and it was based on getting started right away. But we didn't get started right away, and the stakeholders warned that the problem was only going to get bigger and more expensive to fix. Now we're looking at closer to $100 million a year. The 2006 legislature provided a total of $24.9 million for fiscal year 2007 to begin Clean Water Legacy. It was certainly a start, but short of the $100 million needed. This year, the governor's budget for 2008 and 2009 provides $20 million per year from the general fund, $80 million less than what is needed. The funding is divided between the agencies charged with implementing the act, and for the most part, the agencies are receiving the same funding as 2007, minus the $5.5 million in bond funds received in 2007. Obviously, this isn't a ramp-up. In addition to falling far short of what is needed, there are some challenges with the allocation of the funds. $8.7 million has been allocated for developing and implementing TMDL plans. Very little money, only $1.86 million, is allocated to assessment, which means we aren't finding out what's wrong with the water, and we aren't putting any money into cleaning it up. So these are obviously somewhat alarming trends, and we wanted to present them to you, and we're available for questions.
Any questions, Amanda? I want to draw members' attention to their packets this morning. One of the things we have been doing is asking questions as we've been going along, and we've been getting written responses. And one of the written responses, there's a packet of written responses from Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner of the DNR. And one of them, I think they're all worth absolutely reading, but one of them just struck me particularly, and that was Deputy Commissioner's answer to the question, how much do we need to maintain and operate existing trails? And the answer was, we need an additional $4.8 million annually. That's just for operation and maintenance. I thought that was a startling number, and I just wanted to share that with you, because I think that is, you have accounted for the overall, and I think when we look at the very specifics, it's important to understand where these shortfalls are. Representative
Hanson. Madam Chair, Ms. Schultz, I'm looking at your sheet on the Clean Water Legacy funding, and it has under Bowser County grants for ISTS programs, and think we've seen, maybe with other agency presentations, ISTS programs, are there multiple agencies dealing with ISTS? And, I mean, do you have any idea of the overall amount across agencies, how much is being spent there? Or that may not, if you don't know, that's fine.
No, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that. I can certainly get you that information. Chris Sickford from MCEA would have it.
With regard to the ISTS, we did, and I'm not sure that it's in our packet this morning, and I would ask if I set it aside to be put in our packet, and that is a report from the PCA on ISTS and what is actually happening in that area. And we still have, I believe it's 25% of the 465,000, I believe it is, septic systems are failing. Mm-hmm. Still 25%. And the 10% of them are an imminent threat to public health. Those are big numbers. A problem that I think we absolutely need to deal with. So I'm not sure that that's in your packet, and if it's not, it is in your packet. Yes. I just didn't find it in mine. So, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the first graph on your sheet on treading water, where it's got the high points in 97, 98, 01 fiscal years. Is that CREP funding that affects that?
Representative Hansen, these are operating funds. CREP funding was bonding, and so this trend line does not show the bond funds at all.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In looking at your figures, when you're talking about like the 18% drop, I assume that that's just that's focusing on the general fund.
Representative Osmond, actually, that's all expenditures.
That's all
total expenditures for the primary agencies.
Okay, and that includes along with your agencies, your county and Bowser, as well as the DNR and MPCA. I mean, that's an accumulation of all the different agencies.
Right, Madam Chair, Representative Osmond, that trend line picks up the DNR, PCA, Bowser, and so of course with PCA we've rolled in OEA prior to and then after the merger. Bowser, the Department of Agriculture, and then we also pick up the LCCMR spending and the Metro Park spending, since that was split off from the DNR and allocated separately.
Thank you.
Representative Osmond, one of the things that I noted when I looked at your report that you said, and I don't talk about the pill payments, that we are actually carrying those in our bill this time, and they've substantially increased. So it looks like our budget has increased, but we are giving property tax relief. So it's gone up from, I think, $34 million to $40-some million. So it's a substantial increase. I think pill payments are a good thing, but it makes our budget look bigger. Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative Hoffman.
Madam Chair, you told us to look through our packets, and I apologize. I came in late, but when I came in, we were talking about septic systems. And I look at my packet, it says, let's go fishing. And, Madam Chair, this just doesn't add up.
We'll make sure you get the septic system report that looks like this.
Never come in late.
Any other questions? Thank you so much for coming. Members, I believe we have a quorum now. And we need the minutes, someone to move the minutes of March 1st, 6th, and 8th. Representative McNamara?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes for the members.
Thank you. All those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The minutes have been approved. We have a group of bills before us. Each will is an appropriations bill or involves money and will be laid over for further consideration. But we want to hear from folks, and we're going to start with Representative Peterson.
House File 926.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 926 focuses on the on septic systems, and it specifically requests $3.1 million in 08 to the University of Minnesota Extension Service to study the impact of septic systems on the environment and to provide technical assistance and to small communities and citizens. And you read the bill, you can see how it's cut up. The majority, the biggest chunk goes to a long-term study of medium and large soil treatment systems, and you know, 150,000 septic monitoring study, soil-based treatment system options, study the effectiveness of pre-treatment technologies, moving our phosphorus from soil to surface waters. I think that's an interesting one, given some septic policy in the state. Mr. Hayes can I think spend some time on that, and technical assistance to small communities, and $150,000 to provide more technical assistance in cooperation with the Pollution Control Agency. With me today, I have Mark Hayes from the University of Minnesota Extension, and you could go from there.
Madam Chair, Mark Hayes, I'm just a designer one. I'm not with the university. I'm not an employee. The designers and the inspectors and the pumpers, we work closely with the U, but I want to make it clear that I don't work for them.
Madam Chair, that was my mistake. I think this person's on the university. Thank you.
The bill came about because last year I was called out to a veterans group home in Wright County, and what I found there was conditions similar to what we've seen in the news from Walter Reed, and I kid you not, except this place was on an on-site septic system. And what I found relatively quickly was not only was this an imminent public health threat, but it was an imminent public health threat because these 30 men were on every type of medication you could think of. They sent me the medication list, she was a nurse who comes there and makes sure that the men take their medicine and, you know, give them little checkups and that sort of thing. So the nurse gave me the list of medications. There was about 7 pages of, you know, computer-type medications for 30 men. And it became relatively obvious quickly that these medications had totally decimated the septic system on site. Did a quick search on the internet. The only paper I could find on anything in this area was done in Montana. There's some research currently being done in California, but it's not complete yet. So that's what started this whole thing. Also, the medium and large systems, this group home falls under that. We have a lot of failures. Brand new systems, 2, 3, 5 years old, literally going belly up because of reasons from anywhere from design to installation to usage. And again, everybody thought it was a great idea, but as far as I know, nobody ever actually studied the problem before saying it was a great idea, go ahead. The rest of them I'm going to leave to Dave Gustafson from the U of M because he's the one who is, with the U and the expert on the rest of these. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Dave, my name is Dave Gustafson. I work with the university on-site treatment program. We do the education program and base that on research that's available for us to help develop education programming as well as assist in other policies, in particular rules that govern the on-site here in Minnesota. The research is there to help us to identify and better quantify the risks to help us then better identify and set policy for installing, designing, and using on-sites. The other pieces look at the risk in terms of phosphorus, also working with a number of the small communities that have had some problems in terms of implementing systems over the last probably 3 to 5 years. I guess I'll just open it up for questions, and if there are questions.
Questions, members?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Madam Chair, and I assume that technical assistance related to septic systems to small communities and citizens also includes county units of government. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Representative, yeah, the answer is yes. That and one of the pieces of the assistance is to work through the local county government so that it actually moves everybody forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of looking at this and studying and some of the technical assistance, from your point of view, are there other things that we could be doing to promote septic systems coming into compliance and making sure we know what's out there from your professional experience?
Madam Chair, the university is active in this right now. We have 8 people that are working with on sites, and in particular, 3 of them focus on connecting with small communities. This was the focus of our moving forward as a program, but working with all the other conservation agencies and developing partnerships and moving forward is part of doing that. Also, just connecting with homeowners at some of the other kind of public events is a place that we try to deal with or help make on sites more aware.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd like to find out what the relationship is again with Mr. Hayes in this project.
Just, Madam Chair, Representative Osment, I just work hand in hand with the U as far as they do our education, and I was aware of these problems. Talk to the U. They know that I come down here on a semi-frequently basis and ask me if we could get something going. That's the extent of it.
Okay. The reason I ask, Madam Chair, is that Mr. Hayes, have you turned in your reports that you need to turn in for the LCCMR projects that you're involved with?
Yes, sir, I have.
Okay. On a timely fashion?
Not always.
Okay. There's been significant difficulty there, hasn't there, Mr. Hayes?
To an extent, yes. Okay.
Just like that to be kept in mind as the project goes forward.
I would also like to be kept in mind that when this is passed, I have nothing to do with this. And I've worked with Representative Osment on several things in the past. I do not understand the germaneness of that.
Are there other questions? Members, our very able fiscal analyst has pointed out to me that the committee does not appropriate directly to the University of Minnesota, that this is a bill that will have to go to higher education. So the recommendation should be amended to read that House File 926, and I'll make it. Is recommended to pass to go to finance with a further recommendation that it go to the Committee on Higher Education. Any questions from members? All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposition? Next, Representative Peterson again, and this is House File 1488.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill 1488 would appropriate money to Ecological Services Division at the Department of Natural Resources, and it's focused on native habitats and species, identification and protection, landscape scale planning, invasive species, aquatic and terrestrial, and such. With me today is Tom Landwehr, from the Nature Conservancy. From the bill, you can read $500,000 to develop the expertise on Minnesota's native habitat and species, and $1.5 million per year to manage and restore native habitats through private stewardship efforts and on state natural areas. So it's $2 million in 08 and $2 million in 09. So if Mr. Landwehr could shed some light on why we're here for that, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, Mr. Landwehr.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Landwehr. I'm the Assistant State Director for the Nature Conservancy in Minnesota. We're approaching our 50th year in the state and are pleased to work with the state and the Department of Natural Resources as a partner on many of our conservation projects. As you all know, as members of the committee, we love our natural heritage, we love our natural resources, and we spend a great deal of time and energy trying to conserve those natural resources, both hunted and non-hunted species. I am an avid outdoorsman, hunter, and angler, and spend a considerable amount of time pursuing game and fish, and am a wildlife biologist by training. I would note that if you count ducks as a species, we have roughly two dozen animal species we hunt or trap, roughly two dozen that we angle for, that we fish for. So we have, you know, roughly 50 species that are considered game species in Minnesota. Contrast that to the more than 300 species of non-game in the state that really make up the fabric of our natural heritage. Really is the overwhelming component of our natural heritage. And yet we spend a fairly trivial amount on these non-game species. Roughly 5% of the department's full budget goes to the Division of Ecological Services, so it's a very small amount. And virtually all of that is generated by the general fund. And as you heard from Ms. Appledorn earlier, that number has been going down dramatically in the recent past. Yet we know that our population is going to be increasing roughly 30% over the next several decades, and the pressures that we're applying to fish and wildlife just are increasing every year, not just from our development, but from the new chemicals and the new genetically modified organisms we find out on the land. And our natural heritage is disappearing. In a few weeks, we will have spring peepers coming out. I can't think of a single person that doesn't enjoy the sound of listening to spring peepers. We have cardinals right now that are making their mating calls. Everybody loves the loon. Everybody knows the Blanding's turtle and loves all these species that represent those elements of our natural heritage that really make this a rich state to live. This bill really takes some fairly small steps in increasing the amount of resources we have to both collect the data that we need to know what is out there and where it is, as well as to do a little bit of conservation to help those species. And we applaud Representative Peterson for bringing this to your attention. It really is critical information that we need to collect. We're sort of monitoring the loss of our natural heritage. And while I hope we will be able to turn that around, it's still critical that we do that monitoring. We have to know what's out there, where it is in order to protect it, and have a few dollars to protect it as well. Although Leopold, the father of modern wildlife conservation, once upon a time said that the key to intelligent tinkering is to first save all the pieces. Anybody who's ever taken apart any kid's toy knows that. And I would offer that we are tinkering on a grand scale here. We really need to start saving the pieces better than we have. So we thank you for your support of this, and we'd stand for any questions.
Mr. Landwehr, I'm looking at the specific dollar amounts and how exactly they would be spent and what outcomes we could expect from those expenditures. Why don't you start with the $500,000 to develop ecological expertise. Isn't this something we've already done through the biological survey? Isn't that what this is? I'm trying to understand the difference between our survey, which is going on, and this.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, what we're really talking about here is building sort of staff expertise from the standpoint of providing that expertise to other users. It doesn't help to have people who know this stuff, but they're not able to devote the time to providing information to developers, to other scientists, to other land managers. The County Biological Survey is really an inventory. It provides staff and expertise to go out on the land, map native communities, identify key species, and put that information into a format that can be distributed. But until you then make the connection with having somebody who can interpret that data for a local unit of government, for a city, for a developer, for Fish and Wildlife Service, we're sort of missing that key element. And really, that's what these positions are going to provide. They're going to be the people who can look at the County Biological Survey, recognize what a Western Prairie Fringed Orchid is, what the habitat needs are, and what impacts there might be from proposed developments, and provide that added information to the developer, the local unit of government. So it really is taking the knowledge that we have gained from the County Biological Survey, which is a critical survey, and providing information on how to use that so that we can sustain those species.
So you are essentially talking about DNR hiring some more employees. Can you let me know how many employees you would expect to be hired with this?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, there really are four full-time equivalent permanent specialists here, and those are, as listed, the regional ecologist, prairie policy coordinator, forest policy coordinator, and terrestrial invertebrate specialist. But there are several more field-oriented positions listed in here that may be part-time or seasonal, but are people that are going to be working in the field, collecting information, again, working locally to do conservation, and perhaps using some of the landowner incentive program dollars to actually do conservation on private land. So, for instance, if I own a prairie in southwest Minnesota, and I am interested in conserving that area and making sure that the species on there are sustained, I could contact one of these DNR technicians and they could come out and either assist me with a burn or assist me with identifying where the people are that could do a prescribed burn that would help that prairie.
Representative Hackforth has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Reading the last line of the bill here, it says to restore native habitats through private stewardship efforts. Madam Chair, I'm wondering, is the bill specifically designed just to go to the positions that you talked about, or through the commissioner, are there going to be grants going to private entities such as Nature Conservancy? Is that what the bill is about? I want to know where the money is going to be spent.
Madam Chairman, Representative Hackford, the money is intended primarily for private landowners. If you know how the department works on private lands work, and my first job with the department was a pheasant private land specialist, but when you work with a private landowner, one of the obstacles is primarily the ability to actually spend some money. The landowners have the willingness, but they don't, for instance, have the money to do a burn on their property. They don't have the money to do invasive species control, those types of things. This is money intended directly for that. The money the department spends primarily with private contractors, so a local seed company, for instance, prairie restoration company would be the recipient of the grant via the work with the landowner.
Follow-up, Representative Hackford?
No, that's what I wanted to know.
Thank you. Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Landwehr, kind of on that same track, we generally hear that the DNR is responsible for public lands and that Bowser is responsible for assistance to private landowners. That's not always the case, but we're seeing the Working Lands Initiative, where you have a DNR program with Bowser consultation. Here we seem to have a DNR program that is trying to reach local landowners. I mean, the local Soil and Water Conservation District office may be working with the burn crew already, or they're providing the cost share for the establishment of vegetation. So I'm wondering, you know, if there's really two different things here and two different parts, where perhaps invasive species or perhaps native habitat establishment should go through the existing local delivery system to get out to local units of government to work with folks on getting the projects on the land, and then that the DNR be responsible for making sure they're managing the natives or invasives on their property. So any thoughts on that?
And Chair Representative Hansen, I think the distinction that I always make between Water and Soil Resources and Soil and Water Conservation Districts versus the department is that laws in the SWCDs tend to work on agricultural lands more than anything, croplands or croplands that have been restored to a native habitat, whereas the department, especially if you think of things like the Prairie Bank or other similar programs, are oriented towards what I would call native habitat. Those habitats that are intact, you know, have not been followed up, they're not historically agricultural, with the exception of perhaps some grazing lands. And I think that's a useful distinction, because it is a different set of expertise to work with farmers and croplands versus other landowners who have native habitats. And I think the native habitat expertise in the state is still vested within the Department of Natural Resources, and I think the expertise to work with farmers and cropping systems rests with the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Natural Resource Conservation Service. So I think it's an important distinction. I think you bring up a good point, but I do believe that the repository of this sort of expertise.
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Landwehr is making the case that protecting the native and the associated species with it is an important role for the department, and that they're making the case that they need some assistance, not just constantly being in a restoration mode in the state, and identifying where we can, and the private lands in the state natural areas have, you know, some resources spent not just on always running around to clean up, but identifying those sites that are still intact. And I believe Ecological Services does that best.
I am thinking about the service that DNR provides to private landholders to deal with native prairies and the restoration of native prairies, and how that program is extraordinarily small. And I thought it would be helpful later to look at those specific numbers as we look at this. Any other questions for members? Yes, Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just, from a biologist perspective, you said there's about 300 species in the state of Minnesota, and that includes all species, plants, animals, and birds. Okay, 300 species that you're looking at.
Primarily vertebrates.
Primarily vertebrates. Okay, thank you.
Okay. If you know other questions, I will move... House File 1488 and recommend that the laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you for coming. Next bill on the agenda is also Representative Peterson.
Can we have a committee rule about three in a row?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'll take Representative Hoppy Fishing.
Not in the septic.
Not in the septic. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is another bill focused on ecological services, which we've identified here as about 5% of the DNR's budget. This is $3 million in fiscal year 08 and $3 million in fiscal 09. And it get the money from the Clean Water Legacy as we move forward here. I guess I'm making a case for Ecological Services receiving Clean Water Legacy funds, $250,000 for expanded biological assessment, $1.25 million for collecting natural resource data and delivering it and supporting the TMDL plans, and $1.5 million for expanding the protection and restoration, again, of Minnesota waters. And Mr. Landwehr has some thoughts on this as well.
Mr. Landwehr, and if you could be very specific about how the money would be spent, it would be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And the outcomes that we could expect. Excuse me.
First, in general, to address the significance of this, we're obviously very pleased that the state is looking at the importance of clean water to the state of Minnesota. Whenever we do polling on natural resources, of course, clean water via lakes, streams, and wetlands always rises to the top of the list. And again, as our population grows and our technology expands, we are impacting it more and more frequently. Clean Water Legacy is a comprehensive way of addressing clean water and impaired waters. This is not intended to be the Clean Water Legacy bill. This is just one element of water conservation, and that is recognizing that the waters that we are talking about are systems. They're natural systems. They're biological systems. They're not just related to chemical components or temperature or suspended sediments, that we must also recognize the the critters that live in these things, the animals and the other plants and so on. And just as an example, biologists recognized and hunters recognized for years that scaup, lesser scaup, or bluebills, as we call them in Minnesota, have been in long-term population decline, even while other prairie species of ducks have been increasing with the recent wet years. Biologists could not figure out why this was happening, because the scaup, for the most part, breed in northern boreal forests where the habitat is still intact. Some fairly recent investigations from Minnesota to Louisiana identified the fact that historically scaup gained weight when they were migrating from Louisiana to Canada. Every stop along the way, they put on calories. They were eating food the whole way north, so that when they arrived on the breeding grounds, they were in very good breeding condition. But in a period of 20 years, from about 1980 to 2000, that completely flip-flopped, and scaup, as they started migrating north, were gaining weight all the way to Iowa, and they lost weight as they were flying through Minnesota. Pretty disturbing trend, and pretty disturbing, especially as being somebody from Minnesota. What recent research has suggested is that, in fact, the primary things that scaup are eating, which are invertebrates, phytoserms and copepods, are a couple of small microscopic critters that most people wouldn't recognize, are not available as they have been historically. And when we look at the reason why, the smoking gun appears to be something as innocuous as a fathead minnow. A lot of our wetlands are now connected to other water bodies, and fathead minnows get into these wetlands. Fathead minnows eat these phytoserms and copepods, the same critters that scaup would be eating. So we find that even though the water may be intact, that we get these interactions in them as a result of biological systems, that completely changes the value of these systems. We have to recognize that waters are not just adequately addressed if we keep the pollutants out of them. We also need to look at the biological elements of that. And again, this is what Ecological Services does. They provide the biological expertise on a lot of these things, like cladostomes and copepods, that other people simply don't look at. This bill looks for addresses a couple of issues. One is the Index of Biological Integrity. The IBI really is the first tool we have to sort of compare waters and say, this is in fact a natural water. This is unnatural or degraded for whatever reason. In order to evaluate whether or not water is in a good condition, we have to know what a good condition is. And it's not just as simple as saying, look at a Secchi disk and say that it's clear. We have to know what's in there for species. So the Index of Biological Integrity does that. It establishes base marks for what are desirable endpoints for water in the state of Minnesota. $250,000 is appropriated for that to continue to develop the IBI as a tool for biologists to use. There's $1.25 million for collecting natural resource data and delivering that data to local units of government. The Department of Natural Resources has been very proactive in terms of developing web-based tools. If you look at the Department of Natural Resources website, for instance, you can go to a particular lake. You can pull up a lake. I live in the North Metro, and I fish White Bear, and I fish Bald Eagle a lot. I can go to the DNR's website, and I can pull up maps, hydrograph maps of the lakes. I can find out when they last surveyed the lakes. I can find all kinds of information about it. Outstanding tool, makes it immensely available for users. The same sorts of tools are being developed for providing this kind of biological information to local units of governments or other users. And this $1.25 million would help collect that data and provide that to via the website. And then there's $1.5 million that actually is for on-the-ground activities. So working with shoreline stewardship, working with individual landowners, and working with local units of government to help them develop model ordinances for protecting shoreline. Identifying, again, these purest of Minnesota waters, the sky blue waters of beer and folklore, need protection as well. One of the points Representative Peterson made is that we should not always be trying to restore. We know from native prairie that it is four times more expensive to restore native prairie than it is to preserve it in the first place. And I suspect it's even more greater difference between restore and preserve with water. So recognizing those pristine waters and taking steps to protect the waters is a critical component of water conservation. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's the intention of the bill. That is the specifics in the proposed expenditures of the bill. And again, I would take any questions.
Representative Spells, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Landwehr, can you tell me, if you take some of this money for the expanded biological assessment in Minnesota waters, and you come upon a wetland, and I heard you talk about the scop and the fathead minnows, and I've been doing quite a bit of reading about that. What if you were to find a wetland that for which DNR has issued a permit for someone to raise sucker minnows? They've sold them the eggs, and they're raising sucker minnows who are eating the invertebrates that the scop like to eat. Then if you've taken this money for this assessment, you find that, then what do we expect to get out of this money? What are you going to say to DNR and to this minnow raiser who's degrading the wetland?
Minister Representative Skulls, that's a great question. I think it really points out one of the potential uses for this. I've worked for the Department of Resource Sources for 17 years and actually dealt with the aquaculture issue both here and in the field. And if you look at the aquaculture laws, they're frankly quite tilted toward the aquaculture industry and really provide a lot of motivation for the department to issue aquaculture licenses. Part of what can inform the aquaculture licensing process and that can actually influence the outcome of the licensing is the provision of data that suggests that this is a unique body of water or a certain species that merit protection or you know, other biological arguments. Right now, there is not a lot of that information available. So when an aquaculture license comes up, the wildlife manager sitting out the field looks at this wetland and says, well, you know what? I think that's a pretty good wetland, but all I can base that upon is my knowledge of what's out there. I don't have any biological information, and I frankly don't have the time to go out and collect that biological information. This is the type of data that they would be able to pull up and say, you know what, this wetland, I can tell you what's important about this wetland. I can tell you that if you license this for suckers or walleyes or whatever the species you might be licensing for, you're going to have a negative impact, and therefore the permit ought not be granted. Right now, that's true to the, how's this thing go, back of the pants, it's all done on the fly. There is no good information, and collecting this information is truly the first step in being able to provide that into the process.
Mr. Landwehr, with all due respect, I'm going to push back a little bit on your statement that our laws are tilted toward aquaculture. I don't think that's the case. I think the law is pretty straightforward, and that DNR has tilted toward aquaculture and not followed the law, which actually is quite protective of wetlands. So I think we will both have to go back and reread the statute, but my reading says that licenses can't be issued if there's going to be damage to the wetland. And we know that there are damage to the wetland, and we know that licenses are being issued. So I think whoever wrote the law originally did a pretty good job. The way DNR has interpreted it is more than problematic. Representative Moe has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I risk going down this road a bit further. You suggested early on that the reason for the decline of bluebills is the proliferation of fathead minnows, not sucker minnows, in wetlands. Is that anecdotal evidence? You've suggested just in your past statement that this information is needed. So maybe suggesting that we don't have it now. Could you kind of give us an assessment of where the real data is on this right now? Because this is an important issue for many of us who might fall on either side of that, the implications for that research.
Madam Chair, Representative Moles, the information on the interaction between fatheads and invertebrates and scop has really just been developed over about the last 8 years. And there have been both studies done by Dr. Al Afton at the University of Louisiana and our own Mark Hansen, who's with the Department of Natural Resources up in Bemidji, to look at these, they call them trophic interactions. And Dr. Afton is one who documented the change in weights of scop as they're migrating north. He did it actually when he was working for the Department of Natural Resources in 1980, took samples along the Mississippi Flyway of scop as they're migrating, and then his graduate student, Mark Anto, took the same measurements in the same locations 20 years later. So they put together a couple of papers that document this decline in weight in the spring migration of scop. At the same time, Mark Hansen, who was looking at some information from Europe that identified these potential competitions between fish and ducks, started doing investigations, controlled experiments both in North Dakota and in Minnesota to look at what was happening in water bodies that had fatheads versus water bodies that did not. And it is specific to fatheads. Fathead, because of the size of their mouth, because of their diet, because of their proliferation, tend to eat the same things that scop do. And they eat them voraciously, and they multiply many times over in a season. So you have a small population in the spring that will bloom substantially over the winter, over the summer, and just wipe out all of the invertebrates that are specific size that typically are the ones that the scop eat. So it's a number of factors. We've had high water over the last 10 years that has allowed the overwintering of fatheads in areas where they haven't been before. We've connected many of our wetlands via drains and tiles so that they can migrate from winter refugia. And we have, we've fostered high water by allowing some of the drainage and so on into these wetlands. You don't get the same impact from different fish species. So, for instance, in places where we have had a demonstrated problem with fathead minnows eating these invertebrates, the department has experimented with putting in walleye fry. Well, walleye, for a very short amount of time, also eat these small clodocerans, but after they get to a few inches in length, now they're eating fatheads. And the department has shown that by introducing walleye, they can clean these water bodies up. One of the interactions of fatheads is that as they eat these small cladocerans and copepods, those small invertebrates were eating the algae. And so they were keeping the algae population down. When you get rid of the cladocerans by introducing the fatheads, the algae blooms. When the algae blooms, you can't get sunlight to the bottom of the water body, so you can't get the rooted plant. So you go from this clear water, rooted plant, native system to a muddy, fathead-dominated system, and if you get the shift back and forth by throwing the walleyes back in, they've been able to shift them back into a clear water state. So they get different impacts from different species, and it's fatheads have been identified as a smoking gun, specifically with scop, although it's probably other things as well.
Thank you. I don't see any questions. Mr. Johnson, did you want to testify on this bill? Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee. If you give your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. Just some very brief comments, Madam Chair, and it has to do with the reference in the bill to the Clean Water Legacy Act. Most of you were either around for the debates over the past couple of years or have caught up on them quickly over the need for funding to clean up impaired waters in the state. My concern with the way this was put together is something that we're working on with the Nature Conservancy to fix the language, and we'll be working with Representative Peterson and the Senate author as well. But the package that the G16 put together for the Clean Water Legacy Act, the $81 million number that some of you have probably seen the spreadsheet on, actually has a number of line items for these very issues in it for Ecological Services at DNR to do this kind of work as part of that package. Our concern is that we don't want to see the Clean Water Legacy package split into small chunks and funded individually. This is a comprehensive agency, multi-agency effort that needs to be done. And, for instance, the Pollution Control Agency's funding for assessment and monitoring is also not currently in the governor's budget at a level that is adequate to get the data we need to complete these CMDLs. So my only concern is that we not split off individual chunks of work on impaired waters, agency division by agency division. There's also some concerns I'm working on just with wording that, for instance, in item number 2 on here, $1.25 million per year for collecting natural resource data, etc. It ends with for development of TMDL plans by local units of government. We actually don't develop the TMDL plans. That's done by the Pollution Control Agency and a stakeholder process that lasts for a considerable amount of time. That said, the data that they are talking about here is very useful to our local units of government. Knowing where sensitive areas are, where we need to focus our efforts locally, is something my local governments very much want. but it is not necessarily part of the clean water legacy work that we do. It's much more often used in terms of land conservation and sensitive area set aside. So that was the reason I wanted to make a few brief comments, Madam Chair, is just to separate this issue from the actual biological work we need to do on the Clean Water Legacy Act to find out where we have impaired waters for biota standards.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may, I think it's important to have groups working together, but I think we also give up our position as elected representatives if we don't insert our opinions into what groups are working on. And although I do think the G16 probably spent, and I know they spent a lot of time on developing a clean water legacy, yet we still have a governor who likes the term and the logo clean water legacy, but doesn't seem to want to fund it. So while we languish and have discussions in meetings and such, and commissioners come and tell you you're doing great work, but you don't get any money, I'm not really willing to sit around and wait. And I believe in my tenure here, I've seen ecological services take a backseat to some other activities at these agencies. And I'm just inserting my opinion here that ecological services understands these interactions between the index for biological integrity and such. We can find places in Minnesota that we don't need to restore and can assist those that are in the local units and in the counties and such that might not have the expertise, although the intentions are good, to identify some of the things they might be overlooking. So I appreciate the efforts of the G16, but, you know, flexibility and being dynamic is also part of the job, and inserting your opinion into this job as to where you think money should be going, you should not just defer to what groups say.
Thank you. We're going to take one more question from Representative Mo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for Mr. Johnson. So the short of it, though, is the information provided by Ecological Services to cities is valuable and will be helpful for you in several ways, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Mo, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. House File 1489 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The next one on the agenda is Representative Anzels, but we are going to set that aside for just a moment and hear from Representative Junkie on House File 944, which I will move for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Welcome, Representative Junkie. We are a little bit on a fast track here now, so if you would help us out with that. And I see that you have an amendment, and it's a delete everything. I will move that for you. The delete everything amendment is 263 members, and to get it in the order that the author would like it, all of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment is adopted. Oops, I did the wrong one. Okay. Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're setting up here. We have about a three-minute presentation that I think explains what Let's Go Fishing is to folks that are unaware. Those that have been around here, I think, know what it is. The amendment you just put on basically moved from the Game and Fish Fund to the General Fund and also added the word fishing and boating. Boating was added, and this amendment came at the suggestion of the DNR, who thought this fit a lot better in what their vision was of this program and certainly our ongoing vision. With that, members, I'll turn it over here to my witnesses to present to you quickly here what they have
Thank you.
Whoever's doing it.
Okay, maybe, Madam Chair, my name is Joe Holm, Director of Let's Go Fishing, and members of the committee. I'd like to maybe just start before we share this video. As far as talking about the mission of Let's Go Fishing, the mission of Let's Go Fishing in Minnesota is dedicated to enriching the lives of individuals aged 55 years and greater through fishing and boating excursions that strengthening communities, build relationships, and create memories. We know the trend of our seniors. We're getting more and more seniors. Minnesota is all about lakes, the memories that we've gotten from the lakes, fishing and boating. What we'd like to do is just share a three-minute video that you may have seen on Minnesota Bound that would sum up some of this before we start our presentation. Maybe for the sake of time, while we're looking at the technical difficulties, there was a handout for everybody that we'd like to go through just to summarize the points of Let's Go Fishing and who we are and how we're impacting people. And why don't we start on that and then we'll turn back, if that'd be okay, Madam Chair?
Yes, and I think you can go through it rather rapidly if you would.
Okay. We're online. Here we go.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Junkie, is this near Wilmer, this video?
Probably.
Probably Green Lake, maybe? Spicer.
Spicer is nice.
Okay.
You know, I'll take an opportunity to talk.
Okay, I think we're just going to have to go ahead with the presentation.
Some loves last a lifetime. One of them is fishing.
I had a nibble.
A nibble means a lot when you can't fish the way you once could. But at any age, there's hope.
Oh, nice one. Small one. Small one. Huh? There you go, Harold.
Harold Van de Ven is fishing today because a Wilmer, Minnesota fella named Joe Holm cared enough to take him and a boatload of other senior anglers.
Sometimes you just have to step out in faith and follow through with some of the things you got a deep conviction about.
Oh, goody.
Convinced senior citizens would love to go fishing if given the chance, Joe founded a volunteer organization called Let's Go Fishing.
I tell my wife that I got two full-time jobs, but this is the one that pays the long-term dividends. There is so much gratification that comes from helping people and to see that smile on their face and to know that you made a difference.
Using volunteers as fishing guides, a fishing trip for seniors doesn't cost a dime.
You know, I think there's a lot of times when seniors think they're forgotten, and we don't want them to think that way. We invite them out and just say, they're at a party here.
It's just really awesome getting the seniors out on the water. My mom and dad passed away about 2 years ago. They were 93 and 92. And then when Joel introduced this concept, I thought it was the greatest thing I could think of because my mom and dad were unable to get on the water at a certain point in their lives.
That's wonderful. That's something money can't buy. Friendship. Today we're in the sunset of our lives. And it starts to cloud over a little bit. And there's nothing more interesting than to get out with friends, knowing you've got friends. We've been a wonderful bunch of guys.
This is a priceless idea that they had of giving a senior a chance to go out and enjoy themselves. Just, I can't say enough about it. I really like it. You know, I'm a retired teacher, and some of these volunteers I had in school. So it's kind of nice to have them helping me. But one time I helped them. So that's just payback.
A payback, perhaps. Founder Joe Holm is hoping the idea spreads from Minnesota's Green Lake to fishing waters across America.
I think the older all of us get, the more sensitive we really become that life is fragile. And you don't know when your time's up. And that friendship, somebody just come up
put your arm around them and just treat them like a fishing buddy.
Well, I'm glad.
Yeah,
that was really wonderful.
Let's go fishing. Not a bad idea at any age.
Madam Chair and committee members, from Baudette to Fairmont, from Martinville to North Branch, there are literally thousands of seniors right now that just can't wait to get on the water again. It is just amazing on how we've got seniors in all of our lives that every single taxpayer in Minnesota is either directly or indirectly by this program in a positive way. On the first page is a summary of the last 5 years. The number of senior guests that have been touched with this program has been more than 9,000. And as far as the excursions, the communities that have taken promotional events, reaching out to people, have been more than 50,000 attendees. Through the end of 2006, we had 725 volunteers. We project now in 2007 we'll be over 1,000 volunteers. We flip that page over. Who has benefited from the Let's Go Fishing program? Not only individuals, but groups of all walks of life have benefited from this program. It's amazing the one thing every one of these communities have said is that they've heard a common theme of people saying, thank you, I didn't think anybody cared. Not only has this made my whole day, this has made my whole year. I just talked to a lady not too long ago. She pointed out her window at a snowbank and said, let's go fishing. That's what I have to look forward to right now. So it's impacted people of all walks of life. The following page, as far as the ways that it's impacted people, both on the seniors, you can read the bullet points, how it has affected the seniors as well as how it has affected the communities. The communities have absolutely fallen in love with the program as far as just a great community outreach. The interesting part on the bottom is that you can see the numbers from when we started in 2002 to when we got the statistics with the state fundings last time we were here and how they just skyrocketed. So it went from an idea to a seed to a full-fledged program right now. The following page, when you look at the states, you can see that last time we were here, there was basically three communities. Each community serves an area about a 30 to 40-mile radius. And you can see they're spread all over the map right now. The following page is the request. Let's Go Fishing is requesting in House Senate number 944, $350,000 for 2008, $350,000 for 2009. And again, we can go by history to know the numbers of people that we can impact. We know this year alone in 2007 will be about 7,500 people. So it's a unique program with an unlimited amount of potential. Madam Chair, that's all I've got right there. If there's any questions.
Okay. Are there pressing questions, members? I think folks know a lot about this.
Just one quick comment.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for people in the Bemidji Walker area. There are literally hundreds of people that haven't gone fishing in 10 or 15 years. And I've volunteered for this too. Seeing them come off the lake, it's just remarkable. Unlike any other experience I've had out fishing. So thank you for your work and thank you. And thank you for saving us.
And Madam Chair, just on the request, so the committee understands, the request really is they've gotten to the point they can't expand with the personnel and others that they have. We're looking to the DNR to pick this up as one of their programs like Minocqua, the other things they do. We think this is a great outreach program. They're working with our nursing homes. They're working with others around
Madam Chair, they can't even think about coming into the Twin Cities, and we know there's a huge demand here, too, until they set up some regional coordination offices, and that's what this money is for. Similar to what Minocqua does, we'd like to see about 4 regional offices with this money, with a coordinator to continue expanding and training and helping these folks get their pontoon, get their equipment, get the things they need to get going in the community. So that's what the request is for.
Let me just ask, if I remember, folks do have to get a fishing license, right?
Madam Chair, regarding the fishing license, yes, they do. Everything else is provided for. In fact, there's been a lot of fishing licenses being sold because of this program.
That's what I thought. So, Representative Junkie, help me understand why you want to come from the general fund where we have no money instead of...
Madam Chair, I'm happy to discuss Game and Fish or General Fund. Again, this amendment came from a request from the DNR to do it out of the General Fund. So that was their advice to me after meeting with some of their fiscal folks in the last week or two.
Maybe they're holding some General Fund monies that we don't know about, Representative Thompson.
I don't know about that.
Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Junkie, I'm curious about the Let's Go Fishing as a 501c3 nonprofit organization. In light of the recent legislative auditor's report about grants to nonprofits, can you tell me what types of parameters are in place to kind of be watchful of how this money is distributed?
Well, Madam Chair, I can tell you, Representative Finkelstein, I can tell you this, that the last dollars they got a couple of years ago all came through the Department of Natural Resources. Not $1 went out until they submitted their bills and all the other things for reimbursement. They weren't just given the money. It was actually filtered and watched very closely. In fact, probably we would complain maybe too closely by the DNR. It's very difficult to access that money, and they really had the clamps on it. So, I mean, that's why we think it's important to work with their group and even see if there's some synergies within the department, whether it's website work or other things that we could maybe cross over with and save some money if we partner. You know, private-public type partnerships work real well, I think, when they're done right.
Representative Osborne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Junkie, I'm wondering about the inclusion now of the age 55 and older. What came about to pick that age? I'm older than that, and I'm figuring that I can go fish. So I'm wondering why we didn't pick the 62 or 65 age group.
Madam Chair, sir, the... at the inception of the program, year 2002, we asked ourselves that question. And at that point is where the AARP was at 55. That was the benchmark that we decided to take. Presently, the AARP is at 50. We just made a decision that we'll keep it at 55, although I'd like to add we've never said no. So we won't need the card yet.
And Madam Chair, Representative Osborne, again, this is mainly a program for those that haven't been on the lake, can't get on the lake, so they're really looking at either handicapped folks, I mean, their boats are equipped for wheelchairs and things, or if it's age 55, maybe a widow, perhaps who used to go fishing with her husband who passed away 10 years ago and hasn't been on the lake, even though she might be physically capable, there's just no one that's taken her, and it, you know, brings back that memory. So it's, even though I don't think it's as age-specific as you think, I think it's more client-specific when they really look at it.
The reason is because I look at the original. I don't think we've had that the age actually specified in statute before. That's the reason why I'm wondering why that. Because I'm not. The program's fine, and I think the way it's been carried out and passed, the policy has been fine. Putting the age specific in statute is what I'm a little bit concerned with.
With no further questions, it'll be laid. 9:44 will be laid over for further consideration. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We appreciate it.
Committee.
Representative Van Zelt. You lucked out. Okay, we'll do it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
this morning and night. Welcome.
Thank you.
Front of the committee.
Madam Chair and members, House File 607 is before you. Joining me are two familiar faces, John Howard and Steve Korstad, who are the technical experts on plasma torch gasification. As you know, the border communities in northern Minnesota are sparsely populated and remote. And that is a factor in hopefully justifying a $400,000 appropriation to study the feasibility of constructing a facility to be located in International Falls, Minnesota, county of Kuchiching. Population in the entire county is approximately 14,000. Population in the adjoining county to the west, Lake of the Woods County, approximately 4,500. And northern St. Louis County, another approximately 40,000 sparsely populated areas. The purpose behind this is, I suppose, threefold. One, create energy. Two, reduce dependence on landfills. And thirdly, the economic activity and energy consumption reduction that will occur by not having to transport municipal solid waste to landfills. With that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues and be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you. If you would put your name on the record, and we're watching the clocks, and we have one bill after yours. So.
Absolutely, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Steve Korstad. I'm with Coronal. My partner, John Howard, Coronal. We have a consulting development contract with Cushing County for this project, Renewable Energy Clean Air Project. You probably have seen this slide, members, just to review. It's our Minnesota waste profile. We're generating about 6 million tons of garbage now in the state of Minnesota, and rising, as you can see. We are recycling about 39%. That's in the green. In the red, we do have a waste energy infrastructure. There are about a dozen incinerators that are taking that waste and turning it into energy. As you can see, that's kind of going down in percentage-wise. And then the black is the main problem, that we're putting over 2 million tons of garbage into landfills. Now, the PCA has taken a goal for 2011 here to try to increase the recycling up to 50%. But the big thing here is to try to get the amount going to the landfills to decrease. And by doing that, it's doubling the capacity for waste to energy. The amount is at 7 million in that year, they're projecting. And we're hoping to get about 35% waste to energy. And that's where our project comes in. We can help create that red capacity there. One of the main problems in landfills is the methane that comes out of the landfills. It's a bad greenhouse gas. It's about 20 times worse than CO2. This is a national figure slide that shows the amount of the carbon footprint, the amount of methane going out. The gold part there is we are capturing some of this methane into a recovery. In fact, you can see that is increasing up to about 20-25%. However, the black is what's going up into the atmosphere for greenhouse gas. And our project eliminates landfill, hence we eliminate this gas and so forth. The next one, I'll turn it over to John, my partner.
Madam Chair, John Howard with Coronal. This slide really focuses on our intent to work within the statute, the Minnesota statute. Waste reduction, waste recycling, composting, and then here we have inserted plasma gasification. If we intercept, if you will, the waste stream going through the landfill and incinerators, we remove the bottom half of this pyramid, and it's an opportunity for revenue for the state and the counties that would run these facilities. We talked about air emissions and the solid byproducts. Basically, we outperform existing incinerators. And so this technology speaks to, once again, having a cleaner environment, being more responsible with the waste, and eliminating liabilities, if you will, for the future as we put things into the ground. What Steve is passing out is one of the byproducts, the solid byproducts of the process.
On this slide, if you go back.
Sure. Yeah.
And I look at lead and, well, no mercury, for example. When you say there is less in gasification, is it because it is all then in the solid byproducts, or is there any less in the gas?
The chemical pollutants, the nasties, if you will, that typically go up the stack and are present in ash when it goes into the landfill. In this process, we encapsulate it, and I will show you a...
I understand that you're encapsulating it. My question is, you've encapsulated this much.
Correct.
Nothing is going up the stack, nothing is going into the water, and nothing is going into the gas itself, that the energy you've created? That's my question.
There, if you will, trace amounts in all directions. However, as I said, the encapsulation, we render the pollutant into a state in which it is benign. Unlike incineration, the air emissions, the ash ultimately goes into the ground. And so, in comparison to that, we outperform incineration with this encapsulation. Doesn't exist in any other waste-to-energy solution.
I understand the outperformance. My question is more how much is like ending up in the gas that somebody else is going to burn. And that is a question that it's been hard to get an answer to.
It does not end up in the gas. You have two places where it can go. And when I keep coming back to the encapsulation, the crystalline structure captures the pollutant. And so it doesn't go in other paths, unlike these other technologies. So hopefully that addresses your concern. And so, no, it doesn't go up the stack. And even if it did go beyond that point, you have the best available technology, the gas capturing for the baghouse on the exhaust, if you will, to capture the residuals. So we have the solution. As I said, we're trying to bring to Cochin County. This is a block diagram of the solution, which many of you have seen. And as I said, our intent is to offer a safety net, if you will, towards recycling and capture waste that otherwise would have gone to the landfill with the front end of this facility. And at the end of the day, we produce a slag which diverts the waste from the landfill, a synthetic gas, steam, and or electrons are byproducts. So with that, I will wait for questions.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. How do you fire this plant? What would you use for energy to produce the heat to the 20,000 degrees Fahrenheit?
Madam Chair, Representative, if you look at position two, the torch itself will be on startup fired by electricity from the grid. Now, there's enough energy released in the process to, at position 10, produce enough electricity to then come back and fire the torch. And so we have the ability to disconnect from the grid, and the torch then becomes a parasitic load. And as long as we continue to supply waste into the process, it keeps going.
Yes, Representative Gartner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scalzi, it's a little bit like an alternator. Once you get the initial jolt off the battery, everything keeps circulating.
Yeah.
I was familiar with this project a little bit in my work in recycling before coming to the legislature, so I've heard this about some times. But, you know, I think the feasibility study is going to answer questions that I think some of us who are familiar with solid waste have, which is, you know, how the metals that literally melt away in the torch would be separated to have some value for end markets. There's a Japanese facility that does plasma gasification, and to see the video of this stuff actually melting is interesting, and that brings up a whole range of other questions. If the PCA is going to move away from as much landfilling as we do now, the existing waste energy facility designs are not necessarily a desirable option, and this one, just because of the high temperatures, takes care of the dioxins and the furans that we're worried about with some of the municipal waste incinerators. So there's some promise here, and I've been supportive of the idea of the feasibility study just to answer a lot of the questions and also to figure out how the logistics work. And in terms of landfills, I kind of wondered why International Falls, but if you look at a map of our waste disposal facilities in Minnesota, the closest ones are in Virginia and Kitson County. And while I never cry over high garbage prices because it incentivizes recycling, I think going to Kitson County is a little ridiculous. So there's some merit here.
Thank you. Yes, Representative McNair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anzuck, I have just a couple of questions. One, in last year's bonding bill, we, I think, gave this project $2.5 million with the stipulation that it fined $2.5 million of non-state money. I was curious to know the status on that effort to find funding outside of state funds for this project.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, it's my understanding that $2.5 million in bonding dollars has not gone anywhere, and I'm not aware of any leveraging that's been done to this point, pending getting this appropriation to do the feasibility study. I believe that money is still there and will be leveraged. Ultimately, what we'll have here, assuming everything keeps moving and the money is appropriated to do the study, and the study comes back with promise, this will be a $30 million project, joint project, shared equally between the local folks and the Fed.
Madam Chair, one other follow-up. Representative Anzuck. Would this project, and I'm not sure the logistics of it, but does this county, could this be funded through IRRRB money also?
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, thank you for asking. Coochin County, except for a small slice on the extreme eastern portion of the county, Coochin County is not included in the Taconite Economic Protection or Taconite Environmental Protection areas. There are days when I wish it could be, and today is probably one of them.
Thank you. Representative Ansels, would you like to move this for possible inclusion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 607 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Anslack has moved it for possible inclusion, and that is what we will do. Thank you, Representative Anslack. Members, we have two bills left. They will be done on Thursday because of our time come up. On Thursday, we meet during the morning and in the evening. We will try to take at least most of the bills that we still have before us. With that,